Good evening and welcome to the talking show. It is, what day is it?
It's the 30th.
Oh, it's the 30th of September. Welcome. We are here in the K Cheng studio. I, Steve Cato, and
I, Nicholas Miller, waving to Steve through the sneeze proof, cough proof, droplet proof plexiglass.
Yes. And I think we fixed the technical difficulties we had last week, right? The thing with the voice isn't happening, really.
Yeah.
But there are separate ventilation systems for each pod here. And so I think the fan in mine's on a little loud. I don't know if you can you hear that?
Not really, but, you know.
No, well, we'll see how it comes out on the broadcast. I feel like it's louder than usual, but at the same time, I guess it was a very hot day today, so.
Yeah, and it hasn't cooled off here at K-Chung, which is a unique feature of the studios here.
It's a flat asphalt roof, you know, it picks up all the heat.
Yeah. They should toss a few rain chains up there. I hear that really cools things off.
Really?
No, I'm joking.
What's a rain chain?
Like a mid-century California modernism case study house way.
Oh!
Where it's like the gutter leads to a chain.
Yeah.
And then the water runs on the chain, which I think look lovely.
That's from Japan.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, so many of these efficient architectural principles adopted by the United States at that time. But I've never seen one working, but also, you know, doesn't rain too much.
Yeah, I mean, you are an ideally placed globally, like on the surface of the earth, so to speak, to see any rain management stuff in direct action frequently.
Right. Nor do I think that method is intended for, you know, heavy flow areas.
I disagree. In Japan, it's common and it rains like a motherfucker in Japan.
Okay.
Yeah, they have a whole season. It's called the rainy season.
Well, there you
go. And it is moist during the rainy season. And that's when the rain chains, I wonder what they're called in Japanese. Probably just like rain and chain put together.
Yeah.
As so many things in Japanese are. But yeah, they work great. My grandparents' place in Hiroshima had one.
Oh, wow.
And I watched the rain dribble down it. The problem, my father explained to me, I was like, also, like you, I thought they looked beautiful. And I was enchanted by it. And I was like, how come we don't have these at home? And he said, because it freezes.
The chain does.
And the freezing winter. Yeah. So if the liquid's running down it and then the, you know, and water freezing, all this stuff, it's apparently very bad, should be avoided.
You just get like a frozen bat that could fall on anyone.
Yeah, or who knows? I'm not quite sure what I get. Possibly, maybe it like the expanding freezing water breaks the chains. Maybe.
What a metaphor!
Replace the links. Totally. But who's to say? I'm not sure exactly why. Why freezing was such a big problem per se, but or why eaves are better necessarily, you know, because I'm sure they still conduct the water and the water still freezes in like a regular drain spout. So I'll have to ask my father next time I speak to him what was the problem with rain chains and freezing. Also, because like frankly parts of Japan get quite cold as well, like in Hokkaido and stuff.
That's true. Yeah.
It wasn't really a problem in Hiroshima. It doesn't really get that cold. But, you know, I wonder if, well, maybe they just don't have rain chains in Hokkaido. I don't know. The answer is I don't know. I have no idea how it works in Japan beyond having been there once when I was 11. Yeah. It's true. Rain chains are very common in Pasadena.
I see them all the time.
Yeah, it's a big feature of that generation of mid-century modern house.
Yeah, well, it makes sense given that you pointed out that it's a Japanese bit of architecture because of the green boys had such a cast such a long shadow here, and they were
taking
trips to Japan and bringing that those designs here.
Rain chain, bro. Check it out.
I did the other day drive down Beethoven Street in Santa Monica. Have you done that and seen all the like the solid row of like 10 case study houses?
Yeah, I briefly lived on Beethoven Street when I was cat sitting for Leslie Dick.
Oh wow. Does she live on the same block as the case studies?
No. Mm. But you know, it was on it's also such a great I wish that there was more of that. You know, just like full throated, just like put the cannon on the street name. You know, why is it always the name of the developer or whatever? You know, like,
yeah.
And even if we eventually don't hold those people to be in such high esteem, if we like cancel Beethoven or whatever, then the street names are at least like a reference to like the fact that at one point we cared about that. You know, you're like, oh, at one point Beethoven was not canceled.
I wonder what he could be canceled for. I feel like he had only unrequited love, right?
I think he was quite a bastard. I'm sure there's lots of things he could get. I mean, in his favor, there's the persistent rumor that he was half black.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, he's definitely more progressive or interesting than Mozart.
Right.
So if anything, Mozart Street canceled. we're renaming Mozart Street Julius Eastman Way. But I don't know. I was impressed by Mexico City, how the streets were named by district, kind of. So there was like a philosopher district, mm-hmm. you know, and if someone really made it, they named a street after, like, you know, if you were maybe. Because I think his profile in Latin America is quite large, actually. You know, they'll name a street after Zizek or something like that.
Yeah.
In that, you know, it'll be around the corner from, like, Heidegger Street. And they're like, oh, yeah, Heidegger. Not good. But, you know, like, a big deal. You know, like, and you get, so therefore you get a street in this area, you know, and there's, like, a poetry area and different sort of levels of political interaction. Like, these were all the Aztec rulers. These streets are all named after them. These are all the Spanish rulers, you know, and you'd think that if you were, I feel like American history is so univocal, you know, at least in the sense, you know, I guess we would rather it weren't so univocal, maybe that's the point. But so you always have Washington and Jefferson and Adams and streets named after those guys, but there's no streets named after like the English colonial rulers or like, you know, and to be fair, we have a lot of streets in California named after the Spanish colonists as well. So there is that. But, you know, it'd be good to just have everyone, you know, you just have everyone on there and everyone can be like, oh, yeah, well, turns out we hate them now, you know, but like that's right around the corner from like the statesman I like or whatever, you know, like, oh, yeah, but around the corner is like Howard Zinn Road or whatever, or like Amy Goodman Boulevard. what have you?
Juan Gonzalez
yeah,
Way.
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, I want really broad representation. I guess well yeah, and it's funny, like in Texas, you'd look up who the street was named after and like what the guy did was literally so awful.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, no. None of the people who have stuff named after them in Texas were like so what did he do? He's like he used a sharp knife to disembowel a man he was fighting with. And you're like, anything else? Is like native genocide. And you're like, what else? And they're like, stole. Was famous for stealing. And you're like, so anything else? He's like, bigamist. And you're like, okay.
Give him a county.
What else did this guy do? And they're like, cheated at cards a lot too. And you're like, no way.
Right.
You're like, that's why you got in the fight with a guy who he disemboweled. And you're like, that's great. Like, it's not, you know, it's not even like, you know, signing the Constitution or what, you know, whatever you think of Virginian landowning slave owners who, you know, got their names on everything. You know, at least they sort of like have some legislative achievements, you know, like they put some stuff, they signed their names on some documents. They, they created some legal infrastructure, whereas like just these like sort of wasted brawlers, you know, and then they get like the entire state of Texas named after them, basically. Yeah, that part is really astonishing. You're like, wow, the bar to entry for getting something named after you in middle 1800s Texas was really low.
Yeah. you just had to be a quick shot.
Yeah, or just like extraordinarily mean.
Yeah.
Just like so grumpy. Everyone's like, that guy's so grumpy. Don't talk to him. He'll stab you.
Right. With his mustache.
Yeah. It's a trip. It's like, it is really wild thinking, you know, I've been doing these billboards for SMP LA and, or SNP LA. And the one of them is just where Obama Boulevard starts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because it's like, oh, I don't think I've had like direct knowledge of the person that the street was named after before. You know, like Washington, Jefferson, very abstract.
Yeah, Adams.
Vinyes, you know, Alvarado, you know, all very abstract. All a long time ago that we had to deal with those people as humans. And then Barack Obama is like, you know, like I went to grad school the year that he was elected.
Yeah.
And like, it's like, oh, you know, like in the scheme of things, not that long ago, I remember it quite clearly. So that, yeah, that part's weird. I don't know. I don't know how I feel. I think we should try and normalize it. I think we should try and name stuff after everyone. Like we should just have like, yeah, we should start naming streets after like, you know, actors here in Los Angeles.
I'm sure that happens somewhere.
I'm sure there's a couple really beloved figures, you know, but I don't think, like, I think there should be a part of Hollywood where you're like, oh, that's Peter Falk Drive. Like, we named it after Peter Falk, like, just now, you know? Like, the year he died, we named the street after him.
But they aren't making new streets very often.
I beg to differ. They're making new streets all the time. Construction, the way construction's going, they're hacking and slashing, moving stuff around.
Or even maybe they should do a great service to the people of LA and the visitors to LA, and like, you know, like Figueroa shouldn't span that many towns. Like it doesn't make any
sense.
So it could just,
yeah,
you know,
it's not
be like,
continuous.
All right, in Chinatown it's this, in downtown it's this. Yeah.
And the street stops.
Yeah.
You
can't,
know, like
you
it's
can't
not
continue through.
Yeah, so it's Dwayne Johnson, it's Vin Diesel.
Right.
Down the street from Vin Scully, it's just like Vin Diesel in mm-hmm. Chinatown, and then it's Dwayne Johnson in Highland Park. You know, it's like
Norton, yeah, Simon over here in Pasadena.
You know, he's already got a thing. Should be like, you know, Octavia. Who's famous? Who's a famous Pasadenian?
Octavia Butler.
Who else?
Jackie Robinson. Magic Johnson.
Oh, no way. He's got he must have a street.
He's not, I don't think he's from here, but he has a big presence here.
Because when he was playing for the Lakers is where he lived?
No, I think he's retired to Pasadena, is my understanding, and runs a foundation.
Oh, well, that's nice.
Or maybe when he did play for the Lakers, he lived in Pasadena. Who knows?
Or he lived somewhere else and thought, like, I'd like to retire to Pasadena.
Yeah, exactly.
When he was playing for the Lakers. Yeah, you know, there should be like a Jack Nicholson Way, you mm-hmm. know, next to the stadium. You know, all this shit. We should have all that stuff. Give everyone everything. Yeah. Even like James Condren, whatever, you know, somewhere on the border of Hollywood and West Hollywood near the NBC lot, you know, give him a street. His annoying right. little ass.
Kamala Harris.
Yeah, in San Francisco or something, you know, like mm-hmm. not down here necessarily, but like, yeah, totally. Why not? Let her have it. Jerry Brown Way. Who's to say not? Anyway, you know what else actually is, since there's so much wildfire, when stuff fully burns down, we should just change the whole map. You get to like throw out all the old street names, rebuild everything on new streets, and change the names of all the streets.
Yeah, cleansing, cultural cleansing.
Just switch it all around. You're like, that old layout clearly didn't work.
Nor did the
you want that layout
scheme.
Back? Yeah. How did that work for you? Yeah, it was partially the names. They were cursed. Anyway, did you watch the debates last night?
I did, yeah.
I was unable to. Tell me about it.
They were a fiasco. I remember as a child watching the debates and feeling very intimidated, you know, that I knew that it was important and that parents looked at it, but I had no idea how important it was and what kind of impact it could have. And so, you know, now at this ripe old age, I fully understand what can come from these things. And I remember as a kid thinking that, being really impressed by the level of decorum.
Yeah, everyone debates, seems so formal.
Yeah, and they stand up straight, you know, and they like wear suits with
they do.
One has a blue tie, one has a red tie. They've even abandoned that at this point.
Really? Wait, what kind of ties were going on?
I remember Trump's was red and blue striped, and I want to say Biden's was blue
playing,
and white striped.
Playing both sides.
Yeah, he's a wild card, that guy.
Versatile.
Donnie. Yeah, wild but no, it was like being at a dinner party where some old grumpy men are very drunk and won't listen to each other and just yelling. It was miserable.
It's the highlight reel, if we can call it a highlight reel.
Yeah, low light reel.
It was absolutely abominable. I had to take a mental health thing for it. I was just like, I'm already so, you know, every morning, for good or for ill, I like look at Twitter first thing in the morning.
Okay.
And I think it destroys your brain.
Yeah.
I don't know if I told you this before, but so like I have a friend who lives in Tbilisi. It's a friend of mine from Toronto who works in Tbilisi, and he's Belarusian actually. So, you know, there's a lot of news about Belarus. And not so long ago, I like just sort of reached out to him on Instagram, and I was like, "Oh, you know, just wondering how you're doing. You know, what your thoughts are." And like within 10 minutes, I was like, "All right, is the consolidation of public opinion behind these certain opposition characters that I'm seeing in the West actually just like the usual CIA hack job?" You know? And he was very offended by it, and I was like, "Oh fuck, not everyone's like brain is rotted by like the proximity to like." American discourse, you know,
mm-hmm.
like he, I think for him, he's capable of seeing the situation in Belarus. Well, first of all, I don't doubt that the situation in Belarus is genuinely based on popular anger. You know, I think the people are pissed, right? And the situation sucks and they don't want to deal with this anymore. But possibly the like leaders of the movement are actually the leaders of the movement. You know, it's one of those things where like, I'm just so suspicious of it because like, they'll tell you that like, this man's the leader of the Venezuelan opposition, you know, the people love him. And then like, they're like, so will the people rise up behind him? And like, no, the people actually hate him. You know, like he's a neoliberal banker and the people in Washington decided he was the one that they wanted to, you know, be the face of whatever movement we try to unseat, you know, Maduro with, you know, which isn't to make an argument in favor of Maduro at all, just to say that like, you know, we have this bad track or whatever happened in Bolivia, shit. And like, so I feel like I'm so, or Iraq. So like, I feel so, you know, mind poisoned by the proximity to this stuff where they're always like, this is the great Democrat, you know, the great leader of the Democratic opposition. You're like, oh, that guy sucks, you know, and like no one in Iraq likes him, you know. So I don't know. It was interesting to just be like, oh, fuck, maybe the world isn't entirely like this. And social media has just made my brain this way from exposure to the sort of like overly cynical, overly sort of like black pilled brain space of like the American political arena.
Mm-hmm.
And with that in mind, I was just like, if I look at this debate for 10 seconds, I will like fly into a rage. I'm trying to drink a lot less, you know? And I was like, if I look at this for 10 minutes, I will immediately hit the sauce. Like,
yeah.
Like I am going straight over to the bar. in my apartment and cracking open whatever the fuck's over there and pouring it all down my throat. Like the minute the minute these guys, I hear both of them talk at the same time, I will, you know, like it's already how I felt about both of them individually. Having them both on stage at the same time would like cause me to go insane. So, so you were brave. You took it on. You took it on for both of us here in the talking show, considering that, you know, talking is so important to us.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was a big chunk of talking, important bit of talking, and it was abysmal how pathetic the talking was. I mean, I guess I would say that the that Biden won. If people
really
won. Well, only because it at least through the lenses that I look, the fear on the left was that he would, you know, he wouldn't seem mentally stable, you know, that he would seem mentally degraded enough and one little jab and he would fully like devolve into like baby talk or something, or just like his knees would buckle and he'd crumble on stage. And he seemed, you know, he stood upright the entire time. He looked at the camera. He didn't take the verbal abuse. He took it quite well. And then it just was, you know, constant interruptions. So, I mean, Trump's doing the same thing that got him elected last time, and I still don't quite understand how that happens. So who knows? Who knows what the public...
how it works out.
Yeah, the grander opinions are. But in terms of the fears from the left, I thought, well, Biden, with the very low bar, Biden, you know, he sailed over it.
I heard some highlights, and such as they were, and just in terms of the amount of talking, it seemed like it was like an awful lot of talk, because not only is it 90 minutes, but it's basically both of them talking simultaneously for 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Seems absolutely impossible to sort of parse psychically. I'm very glad I did not watch it. I now, in retrospect, hearing you talk about it, having doom scrolled Twitter this morning at 6 o'clock in the morning when the cats woke me up, you know, I was like, wow, what a bullet I dodged. I watched the episode of Star Trek Enterprise where Scott Bakula's dog contracts an alien parasite and he loses his mind over his beagle being sick, just from worrying, and it's cute. And I think maybe the dog is the best character on Star Trek Enterprise now. You know, I'm like, I'm all here for beagles. But I remember hearing somewhere that beagles are actually kind of bad dogs. So I'm curious. This is obviously a very good dog. But you don't see a lot of beagles around. People, they're not popular anymore. People want like doodles. Different sort of poodle kinds. So, but Snoopy was a beagle, right?
I think so, yeah. Hmm. Well, speaking of bad dogs, we're going to get to hear all about lots of bad dogs tonight.
Indeed. Yeah, welcome aboard. We have a great, speaking of social media brain poison, or speaking directly about the topic of social media brain poisoning, I wouldn't dare to presume on the level of social media infection. I don't know how bad our guest's case is, but we have with us Ingrid Burrington, who's an artist and technologist and comedian, maybe, talking about specifically Zuckerberg in The Hague. So you know, we can all here's a dog can dream, so to speak. here we go, folks.
You know, after the 2016 election, like many other people, I found myself drawn to escapist media. This is some examples. My preferred genres of escapist media tended to be speculative fiction and science fiction, and writings and histories of transitional justice projects, which is to say sort of war crimes tribunals, truth and reconciliation commissions, the systems and bureaucracies constructed kind of in the aftermath of massive political upheaval and traumatic sort of national events. And usually, I don't know, I think of transitional justice actually kind of as its own genre of speculative fiction. It surely is its own kind of world building, perhaps more in the vernacular of law than in the vernacular of literature or design. And the thing I guess I find compelling about both, about speculative narrative and transitional justice, is not that either is useful for kind of finding a simple solution or creating a perfect world. Both are fraught and both fail frequently. But it's maybe the idea that both kind of suggest a belief that kind of regardless of whether the future is dystopian or utopian, it will in fact happen. And although we kind of may never fully come to terms with, you know, traumatic or cataclysmic events, they will not be paralyzing society in perpetuity because, I don't know, I find it to be personally a rather paralyzing present, right? Like, despite kind of the tumult and sound and fury of a media cycle, despite the perpetual sort of like drumbeat of technological progress, there is a sense that it is kind of right now a very ahistorical and anodyne environment. And some of that, but not all, I think might be attributed to living and experiencing those events in relationship to a very ahistorical and anodyne interfaces, right? This was a feature that Slate did last year called The Year in Push Alerts that was one of the most like kind of like painful interactives to watch because it kind of reminded me of that experience that maybe some of you have had of like picking up the phone with a sense of dread of like what fresh hell has unfolded and then swiping it away with your thumb, which feels sort of like not quite the appropriate gesture of response. And I think of the kind of various technical apparatuses and regimes that have been part of this sort of like anodyne ahistorical tendency, Facebook is probably the easiest to pick on. And so I feel kind of bad centering what I'm going to be talking about around that. But I think one of the reasons that, like relative to kind of all the other soulless tech platforms that increasingly shape public life, they're one of the more compelling, it's that kind of more than any of these other companies, their public image is really grounded in this earnest attempt to embody a rhetoric of authenticity and do things for kind of a greater social good and kind of always just sort of get it wrong.
You need to remind yourself that you need to focus and try not to let stuff bother you as much as possible. But it is going to bother you because you're human. And I was human. I am human still. But I was just referring to myself in the past. Not that I was not human.
And I just had to share that with you all. My friend and colleague Tim Malley was once explaining to me a scenario from a Dungeons & Dragons campaign in which a monster comes to your party and takes one of the members of your group and kills them and turns their skin into a suit and then rejoins your party. And you all know, it's pretty obvious this is a monster wearing a skin suit, but you can't quite say anything yet because if you give away the game, the monster will just attack. And Tim was explaining this and he said, this is sort of how I feel about interacting with brands online. And I feel like that kind of is often how I think about Facebook as sort of this monster in a skin suit trying to be human. And if you kind of acknowledge that it isn't, something terrible will happen. I think, again, maybe just as much as kind of Facebook is kind of this fish in a barrel sort of subject, I think the ways in which they institutionalize and absorb language of critique or the language that might be applied to try and hold them accountable as a body is really compelling. This is one of my favorite examples. So this is the Building Global Community blog post that Mark Zuckerberg published in February of 2017. It was one of several examples of, you know, Facebook post-election going, perhaps we have power. We don't know how to think about this. And the thing I found really fascinating about the blog post was the amount of times that Zuckerberg brought up infrastructure. And specifically 15 times he uses this phrase social infrastructure. Sometimes he talks about safety infrastructure, by which he means like the safety check-in feature, the like something bad happened, are you okay thing. And sometimes he sort of tries to like categorize variations of social infrastructure, but like it's sort of throughout the whole thing assumed that those two words are an agreed upon term that requires no definition, no interrogation, no taxonomy. I've read this blog post a few times, and I still don't really know what Mark Zuckerberg thinks social infrastructure is, other than maybe Facebook. At one point, it's sort of like, it sounds like he like read the Wikipedia summary of Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone and is like, we used to be in clubs, and now we're not. Social infrastructure, got it. But then he sort of uses a definition that sounds a little more how a state might describe social infrastructure, like libraries or schools or prisons. And then at other points, it sounds more like he's talking about software features, like the safety check-in or like authentication of identity. And the fuzziness of that term is really fascinating to me as someone who's previous work had largely been about kind of the materiality of network infrastructure, like the actual stuff of the internet, like data centers and their geographies. And, you know, I want to be clear, despite being sort of a grubby materialist, I don't necessarily think that Mark Zuckerberg was using the word infrastructure correctly or incorrectly, and I'm not sure that entirely matters. But I don't know, I really appreciate Paul Edwards's, like, understanding and framing of infrastructure as environment in his essay, Infrastructure and Modernity. But I do think that it's sort of interesting that kind of for all of the frequency with which platforms and large tech companies either kind of by, like themselves or via like kind of other speakers invoke the infrastructural, rarely are they described as sort of legally liable when that infrastructure breaks. In 2009, I think Facebook changed their slogan from move fast and break things to move fast with stable infra. It never really caught on. But, you know, when a car hits a pothole and flips over, the person who is responsible for maintaining the road is usually kind of held liable for that particular harm. When Facebook makes it possible to buy advertisements that violate the Fair Housing Act, they sort of just promise they're going to not do that anymore. And make some like kind of public statements, but very little changes. And there is sort of, as someone who kind of traffics in like the world of people kind of reporting on large tech companies, there's this very familiar and increasingly, I find, tiresome pattern to this sort of reporting, which is first a journalist or security researcher or policy advocate discovers a flaw or technical loophole or dark pattern that perpetuates harm. And then, you know, after publishing documentation of said harm, the reporting produces this sort of meta-reporting, which eventually leads to the company doing kind of one of two things, either sort of promising that they're going to fix it, which they may or may not actually do, or sort of a, like, I'm sorry you feel that way apology that usually kind of gently gestures to the terms of service and moves on. And, you know, generally, like, rarely do these sort of things lead to, like, substantive internal change. And if there are lawsuits, they're usually settled out of court for sums that, you know, while sometimes kind of large, I think one of the bigger ones was like $9.5 million, that's effectively, you know, pocket change for a company like Facebook. And then, you know, when we kind of get towards regulatory frameworks, which, you know, you might see in Europe and sometimes in the United States, but really mostly you're seeing FTC settlement agreements, companies tend to fight or find loopholes around them or find a way to kind of rhetorically position themselves. This is a blog post that was published fairly recently on Facebook's newsroom that didn't get a lot of play, which is called Popularity Does Not Equal Dominance, which is a very confusing argument for why they're not a monopoly, which is like, just people like us. We're not the only platform. There are others, you know, some of which we don't own. Yeah. So last year, there was a particular kind of genre of moral outrage at, you know, a platform's ambiguously defined harms that I found uniquely compelling because of its kind of weird vector with incidents that are typically associated with and documented in transitional justice processes. So you may have seen these stories. So last summer, YouTube rolled out this new machine learning approach to identifying, detecting extremist content or disturbing content on its platform to delete it. And in the process, they removed thousands of videos that had been cataloged and collected by groups like the Syrian Archive and other groups that were trying to gather this not only to kind of understand what was actually going on in Syria, but also for the possibility of kind of future war crimes tribunals. Similar incidents were happening not only on YouTube, but also content was being taken down on Facebook as like violating their community standards because it was considered disturbing. And similar community standard takedowns were happening to people trying to document incidents of ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya in Myanmar. A related story, kind of a few months after a lot of the YouTube stories were happening, was documenting how, basically given the sort of monopoly status that Facebook occupies in Myanmar because internet adoption happened rather late, primarily it's via cell phones. There are more people with Facebook accounts than email addresses in Myanmar. it has a unique position as kind of like determining what information kind of rises to the top of people's kind of understanding of what's happening in the world, and by extension kind of was legitimizing and pushing forward further content that was justifying, you know, ethnic cleansing. And you know, whether or not there will someday be a tribunal for crimes against humanity taking place in Myanmar or in Syria or anywhere, and who will operate said tribunal, and whether or not videos collected via social media will be deemed valid evidence in said tribunal's court of law are like really thorny, uncertain questions, and not necessarily the questions we need to lay it at the feet of Google or Facebook. But I think the disappearance of that evidence from platforms and the kind of uncomfortable amount of, you know, infrastructural, for lack of a better word, kind of presence companies have in these situations, it creates this sort of, I don't know, foreclosure on even kind of the idea of pursuing that imperfect, thorny justice, right? The foreclosure on kind of a certain possibility of a future, which is itself also not really a crime. Like, there are no laws about a human right to history, and canceling the future is not itself a crime against humanity. And I think, in general, this approach, the sort of name and shame, like, point out this terrible thing, feel bad about it, that strategy, in some short-term senses, is actually really smart. Like, I think the guy who's working on that Intercept piece, his main goal was, like, he wanted YouTube to answer the Syrian archives' emails, and he got it. And, like, that's great in that particular kind of one-to-one triage situation. There are lots of situations that are not that straightforward, and there are lots of causes and lots of, you know, international incidents that don't reach a journalist. Not a lot of people speak Burmese. And this is something that, I don't know, I naively, you know, innocent, not a lawyer me, felt a little bit baffled because, I don't know, I sort of hoped that at the point where you start talking about things like literally war crimes, that, like, some adults would start to show up, that, like, legal liability would have to emerge. The adults do not show up. The adults have no idea what to do. And I ended up talking to a bunch of lawyers and writing this sort of long reported essay that got a title that sort of feels like the thing that you do so that you can get people on Facebook to notice it. I really wish that it had a more nuanced title, because the answer is no, and probably never, and that's really all there is to it. I didn't, and this was for The Atlantic back in December, I wasn't really just trying to kind of take 3,500 words to answer the question of, like, why would suing Facebook fail, although that's more or less what I did. Really, what I wanted to kind of understand was, like, why and how Facebook in particular, but tech platforms in general, corporations in general, you know, are able to utilize law to effectively act outside of it, and how platforms have constructed this reality or contributed to the kind of further perpetuation of a reality in which, you know, everyone's sorry, but no one's really responsible. And, you know, of course, I'm going to try not to over-recap this because, like, it's on the internet, you can read it, but, like, you know, most of the methods used by a company like Facebook to avoid liability aren't actually all that different from how, like, a company like ExxonMobil doesn't face liability, and it's really not that different from the reasons that a company like IBM never faced real liability for, like, its role in facilitating the Holocaust. You know, the Nuremberg principles were this huge step forward for challenging the defense of individuals who were just following orders, but we still don't really have a way to challenge corporations who were just following the instructions of the invisible hand of the marketplace. And I think this is maybe a way of just kind of belaboring the point that many of these issues are not new. They seem new given kind of the veneer of tech and given sort of new parameters of present conflicts and specific kind of like subtleties of law, like the Section 230 is of the Communications Decency Act we were talking about earlier. And so I don't know. I've been working on this project kind of trying to understand Facebook as a sort of legal animal and apparatus, and thinking through some of these older kind of precedents and existing legal paradigms as a way to maybe think about moving out of merely thinking about kind of platform accountability and trying to kind of position it more deliberately adversarially within liability. And I'm going to talk about a couple of kind of points to that, like reasons why I think that that's useful and strategies I've been thinking about it more as more as creative narrative projects than necessarily law. So kind of step one. One of the central tropes of discussing holding Facebook accountable for its actions as a company that I tend to notice with other kind of media scholars and like people who work in journalism is, if we could just get them to admit that they're a media company, that would work. That would fix a lot of things. And it would, insofar as it would introduce a lot of regulatory expectations on them, and there would be certain laws that they would be kind of subject to that they're not right now, about like libel and safe harbor and things. But Facebook is a company that's extremely cognizant of the importance of not being framed as a media company, right? Like, they go to great lengths to not do that. You know, I think there's a reason that Facebook leans so heavily on concepts like community and infrastructure, which are pointedly not the same as public or public works. It's kind of nice to remember that, like, as far back as like 2006, Facebook was referring to itself frequently as a social utility, which is a phrase they dropped. This is, so Suri and I have been reading every version of the Facebook Terms of Service and basically track changing them, which is like a really weird Talmudic way to try and like interpret all of the subtleties of what it is to make a corporation. They dropped the social utility language entirely by 2009. And I think, you know, you could kind of argue that they might have realized that, you know, if they continue to kind of signal that they, you know, signal this sort of like idea of utilities, they might actually start getting regulated like one, or people might continue to think that perhaps they should be. So I don't want to say that the strategy of how do we make Facebook a media company is like a meaningless one. Like, I think it's, you know, worth trying or pursuing, but I feel like it's no more quixotic than saying, like, what if we tried to, you know, focus on, like, using civil negligence, like, standards in, like, tort law? You know, I don't think either is, like, any more or less ridiculous. And I don't know, I think about this thing that Sarah Hendren, a designer, an artist who I really admire, said in a commencement speech a few years ago that I think seeing the company for what it actually is, seeing platforms for what they actually are, which are corporations, not chimera, not like magic, not communities, not media companies, is maybe a useful way to try and actually think through what it is to try and change or attack them. The second kind of component that I've been thinking through that I feel like I don't often see brought into accountability and I think might have opportunities in liability is money. So, you know, for the most part, the kind of pursuit of kind of policy transparency and better kind of access to data and regulatory regimes, I think, are good insofar as they tend to be about trying to create conditions where the harms may not happen in the future. But in the case of kind of things like regulation for hate speech or speech that's inciting violence, a lot of the existing proposed frameworks of kind of like fining the company when they don't take something down, like the thing in Germany, it sort of just moves power asymmetry around rather than kind of redistributing or changing the power dynamics, right? Like, either the state is deciding what speech is acceptable or Facebook is in this ad hoc way deciding what speech is acceptable, and both kind of, the user still kind of doesn't have a lot of like agency or feels very little recourse from harm when that's sort of your paradigm. Like, the fines are not going to like the individual user who like was subject to a harassment campaign, for instance. And, you know, putting Facebook's wealth into the hands of citizens isn't quite the same as putting power and agency into their hands, but I think it's maybe a useful way to think about what is the kind of power language that we can use. This is Laurel Patak's Wages for Facebook, which is a website and artwork essay that she made, I think, in 2014, I want to say. It's a website that just sort of, like, voluntarily scrolls through this text kind of inspired by the Wages for Housework manifesto. You know, because whether we think Facebook is a media company or a data broker, like, at the end of the day, it's a corporation, and that means its primary concern and preferred language and vernacular is money. I think that it sounds sort of cutthroat, but I think trying to kind of, rather than saying, like, let's just, like, destroy the company or let's change the company, but let's actually try and, like, deal with the fact that they have entirely too much money is a potentially useful strategy. And I also think maybe one approach to thinking about how to actually enact self-regulation, right? Like, if you can make it really expensive and tedious and annoying, like, one example that I look to is the French railway system that, you know, went through its own kind of process of understanding, like, kind of documenting and coming to terms with its role in facilitating the Holocaust. it wasn't until 2014 that they set up kind of a reparations fund for survivors. And there were many, many, many lawsuits prior to that. And they fought them. And sometimes they won and sometimes they settled. But at a certain point, fighting all of those lawsuits sort of ceases to work. And they kind of finally kind of accepted responsibility for their actions. It may or may not work. This third thing is, and there are kind of institutions that are thinking about how to take these sorts of strategies. The Knight First Amendment Center is one that comes to mind, because I understand lawsuits are expensive, and that's why this approach does not tend to come up that often. So the way that I've been thinking through this as someone who is not a lawyer, not a policy person, a person who tells stories, has largely been going back to my deep love of speculative fiction. I hope for those, I don't know if I need to explain this joke too much, but I don't know. I think that kind of positioning creative and investigative work that exists not in this world, but perhaps like kind of in a world where these previous two concepts of like, well, previous two concepts, I didn't read that part of the text. I'm going through this a lot faster than I thought I did. I didn't know I had this much time when I initially agreed to give this talk, so I apologize in advance.
You're doing great.
Am I? Okay, thanks. Cool. So I think, you know, the thing that I wanted to get at here was basically rather than kind of approaching these propositions that I've been putting forward as like, wouldn't it be great if like this happened? Because like, I don't actually have the resources to make a lot of those things happen. How do I kind of construct a reality in which they already happened? Like, what does that world actually look like? And that's sort of the position in writing, like, we've been writing this sort of annotated like history of like components of Facebook. And like, I have this spreadsheet just called Every Shitty Facebook Thing that is longer, it's actually exactly as long as you'd think. And rather than writing about it as like, be mad, it's like, remember, can you believe we did this for so long? Like, it's kind of about kind of how you position the narrative. And one frame of reference for that, like that I've found useful has been kind of from more speculative fiction and design and art. Last winter, I curated a show at a Haverford College on speculative design and art practices called Future Proof. And the work that I found kind of, that like was the reason I did the show, this is an important, was this project, the show that gave me the idea for like even the premise of like put a bunch of weird futurist projects in the same room. This is the Guantanamo Bay Museum of Art and History, which is a project by Ian Allen Paul. And it started kind of as a one-liner thing in 2012, like a stunt where he said, all right, so assuming that, you know, Barack Obama was able to get Guantanamo closed, what will we do with it, right? What will we actually do with that site? Assuming that, you know, you could kind of get that political groundswell. And so Ian constructed an exhibition of a satellite show from the collective of curators, archivists, and activists who managed to, you know, construct a museum in the same way that, in kind of a similar vein as like the Stasi Museum in East Berlin. And the thing that's sort of weird about making a museum about a political event that has not in fact yet happened and almost certainly won't happen is that it kind of, he kept getting asked to show the project, like it toured and like it kind of other iterations, like the museum has had many exhibitions in this very long life while at the same time it's like, it kind of veers further and further from our timeline. And the particular project that we had in the show was a shadow library, basically looking at, we used kind of like existing photographs of the Guantanamo library to create this like reading room of every book that's been banned from the Guantanamo library. And I don't know, the artifacts and documents included in this work are real items from the timeline, real documentation of real things that have happened at this very real prison. And, you know, in relationship to existing archival initiatives about Guantanamo by human rights groups or legal scholarship institutions, I think what it does that's different by presenting that archive kind of in the register of museology and history is it suggests, it sort of has this demanding, insistent quality to it. It's like, it's not really a speculation so much as a promise that perhaps we could live in a world where the United States is capable of being this self-aware of its own history. And I don't really know if America is actually a place that is capable of that. And I kind of feel, and there's an element of kind of preemptively trying to construct that world that is very risky, but that's kind of why it makes the most sense to kind of approach from the framework of speculative narrative and literature. You know, so much of kind of this existing media ecosystem and critique ecosystem of outrage at platforms sort of vacillates between triage at best and kind of shouting into the void at worst. And the rhetoric of accountability has sort of become this grotesque skin suit worn by corporate monsters. And what I guess I hope to find in directly positioning liability and taking sort of an orthogonal speculative position to imposing that liability as a way to kind of introduce a new narrative is hopefully something that is both imaginative enough to inspire creative action from more pragmatic disciplines and something provocative enough to be kind of too volatile to be turned into yet another skin suit. Whether or not, you know, I end up with a world where Mark Zuckerberg actually has to answer to The Hague, which frankly is unlikely, and even if he did, he'd send his legal counsel instead, or a world in which, you know, maybe Mark Zuckerberg only owns like 4 houses. I think it's that there is a world kind of to be built and a future to be fought for, and it will be imperfect and it will be fraught, but it will happen at all. Thank you.
Wow.
Lock him up.
Wow.
Make this man accountable for his international brain poisoning.
I mean, you think we've got it bad, but it is worth remembering that, like, yeah, there was a genocide of the Rohingya people that was, like, partially... Maybe we shouldn't sharpen the point too much because, like, you know, there were pamphlets that stirred people to do great violence in the European Wars of Religion, for example, right? Like, mm-hmm. That's not the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation was all a bunch of dastardly pamphleteering that caused a lot of genocide to happen. So, I mean, and also pogroms against Jews, you know, also...
A social media project.
Well, a social media project through print.
Yeah, exactly.
Initially, you know, in Europe. So, you know, someone had to print up all those protocols of those elders of Zion and circulate those, or like nail your theses to the door of a church and stir things up, you know. So, but definitely there's a role for Facebook in The Hague, I think, when and if we can imagine anyone will be held responsible for the Rohingya genocide. Yeah, what do you think?
Oh, geez. I mean, I've actually never been on Facebook, so I can't really say. I mean, I mean,
you're on Instagram.
Yeah. Though I don't...
Do you think it makes a big difference?
The impression I get is that Facebook is a place to galvanize political movements, right? It's like highly politicized, and it's mostly there for people at this point to share political opinions and to cajole others into getting involved in their crazy ideologies.
It's not about like sharing pictures of your grandkids and like, you know, vacations or like...
That's my understanding is that it's no longer it's no longer that stuff. It's just political discussion, if you want to call it discussion.
America's doomed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's remarkable that that's the case when initially it was just supposed to be a place where you could debate how hot your classmates were.
Right. Yeah.
And that's different from like Twitter or Instagram.
Such a sad... I mean, these things with sad origin stories. What was the function of Twitter and Instagram?
Well, I would argue Twitter's the same.
Yeah, Twitter definitely. I mean, I looked at it briefly this summer to try and figure it out, but it was incendiary, the voices on there.
It really poisons my whole mind. Mm-hmm. And then Instagram is just pictures of Twitter.
Yeah, it seems to be that way now.
Previously, pictures of what people were eating.
I never thought I would long for those days.
Yeah. For a while, as a function of my age, I guess, like everyone I knew back home was just posting pictures of their kids nonstop because they were having kids. Everyone's having tons of kids. And any of the sort of like shitpost memes, like I guess there's still a few sort of like people making posting funny pictures of things that I can enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I always hated the vacations. I always hated the food. I thought that was the hardest thing to understand. Because I was just like, why? It doesn't even necessarily taste good. We don't know.
The camera's a predator, Steve.
Yeah. Anyway, the food thing drove me nuts. If you could smell the internet, I would say, like, bring on the food pics. You know, now we're talking. But no, until your phone is in smell-o-vision, I'm not interested. But yeah, no, and now it's just pictures of Twitter, which blows my mind. It's like absolutely unusable. Like, why don't you just use Twitter? Jesus. It's all there for you. You know, it's like, it's in highlightable text. You can interact with it directly. So frustrating.
Like there's a social function to buying a DVD and ripping it and uploading it to Karagarga.
Right.
There is no social function in ripping an image from Twitter and putting it in the next social media slot.
Yeah. I mean, in case other people aren't on Twitter, I mean, we can all just get on Twitter if we want to be. Right? Like, it's like you tried it out. You didn't like it.
Yeah.
But nothing was like saying like, Nicholas, you can't.
It's funny. I'm always surprised at the things that surprise me when I try to get involved in something that, you know, everyone says you're supposed to do. And I was surprised that Twitter has advertisements. When I saw them, I thought, of course. But then, you know, at first I thought, oh, I thought it was just a place where you could only have, you know, the constraint was just character based, you know?
Right.
Not that I have to consume a bunch of garbage visually to see what someone's going to rant about.
Yeah. And amazingly, I mean, to be fair, it is pretty light on advertising compared to Instagram or Facebook, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, it's terrible. I mean, it's interesting that despite those ads being there, it has never turned a profit.
Twitter. Huh.
Yeah. And there's no, and unlike Facebook, which, you know, acquires Instagram or like does all this other stuff, you know, or tries to do other stuff at least. Twitter's just Twitter. There's no other product.
Mm-hmm.
There's no the future of Twitter, you know, where it's different. Because it's like to change it would be to like unmake it. You know, if they're like Twitter now with more characters, you're like, it's not, then it's just Facebook.
What's the guy's name? Jack Dorsey or something?
Yeah.
When I lived in Marfa, Texas, he came there for a while. He visited for a while.
Was he nice?
I didn't interact with him. He's there for maybe like a week or two. And then he was going to buy up a bunch of properties, but decided not to for whatever reason. But a lot of people I know did spend time with him. And apparently all he wanted to do was play everyone in ping pong, which I found hilarious given the product he's created is like turned into like kind of political ping pong.
Yeah.
He's just like, I love ping pong.
God, it's incredible that, well, we were talking a little bit earlier, and one of the things I found curious about Ingrid's talk is how she keeps apologizing for the idea that these people would be sent to The Hague. You know, and they're obviously not like the perpetrators of these genocides. Like it's Mark Zuckerberg is not going to Myanmar, former AKA Burma, you know, and like slaughtering a village of Rohingya people. But, you know, insofar as he does have some like material connection to it and could have been, you know, I wouldn't expect him to be tried with like the full war crime, you know, for what it is that he has done. But he should definitely, you know, it's like, to the extent that like a website based on like, are your classmates sexually attractive to you or not, is being, you know, has metastasized into this thing where like you can spread information about atrocities either to raise awareness that the atrocities exist or to promote the doing of the atrocities, and that, you know, that you as an organization are unable to tell the difference between those things. It's not surprising. But like definitely that should have some sort of place, you know, in the discussion about like how harm in the situation was unfurled, you know. And I don't think it's something anyone would need to apologize for. Like I think he should, like if and when, and this will never happen likely, there were to be true attempts at international justice this way, you know, he should definitely go to The Hague. There should definitely be repercussions for Facebook, right? Like, I don't think that's crazy. I think it's just like, you know, less involved, I think, in the situation in Myanmar, but like definitely in America, you know, Jack Dorsey should put down that ping pong paddle for a second and have to answer for how Twitter has sort of unleashed raw bullshit into like the face into American political climate, you know, and should have to face some sort of regulation on top of that, you know, as like the press is regulated, for example, with libel laws and things like that, you know, or if we view it as a utility, you know, electricity, you know, not like there's no room for improvement here in California where like literally the electrical utility just keeps like setting fire to towns. And the gas utility causes toxic gases to just leak into whole canyons that are closed for years afterwards. But, you know, like Aliso Canyon.
Well, in that case, then Facebook is a utility.
Right. Yeah. It's operating exactly like any other Californian utility. Right. Yeah. I suppose you're right. It's like, but, you know, like ostensibly there's regulations in place for these utilities. It's just that they have won very favorable terms and there is very little enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And one would like there to be more enforcement and less favorable terms maybe. But in principle, you know, at least utilities or whatever feel like they come under some sort of public legislation, you know. So I don't think it should be that outlandish, really, you know. What's your feeling on sort of using these concerns and yet also the sort of methods and forms of the technology to itself sort of produce artworks about like Gitmo, for example?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it's my knee-jerk reaction is that I wish more artists were worried about the history of art rather than trying to be basically political pundits in form.
Yeah.
So I don't know our guest's art very well, but from hearing the talk and imagining it, there's a sense that, you know, with the complete destruction of the commons in the 20th century, that art has had to fill the role of everything the commons was. And I
always thought that was restaurants.
Yeah, well, even those are gone now. So it's just art. I never thought it was a form that could hold it all, you know.
Yeah, it can't do everything.
No, and people want it to. So then its fate will be the same fate as Instagram. It will just become like a kind of pitter-patter, impotent political discourse.
I think that's, you know, we've talked about this podcast a bit between ourselves, but Death Panel, Artie Vierkant, sort of just makes art that seems absolutely unconnected to his political beliefs. And I think that's actually how I trust him, both like when he's talking about politics and then subsequently as like a quasi successful artist, you know, I'm like, oh, that seems appropriate because it's like, mm-hmm. you know, like you're not going to be able to discuss healthcare policy in this like brightly chromatic painting.
Yeah. Don't try. Please don't try.
It's not going to work out well. But then how do you feel about the Philip Guston retrospective being canceled?
I don't, you know, it's
funny.
You hear
about this?
No, of course. I saw the news. I don't know much about Philip Guston. I love that portrait of Morton Feldman.
That's very good.
But, you know, I'm not like, he's one
canceled,
of those.
Canceled, by the way. Canceled.
Morton Feldman's
Morty,
canceled?
Rapist.
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely a rapist. Yeah, we talked about this, right? Even that place, The Wild Beast at CalArts, is named after one of his was gifted by a woman he was sleeping with. Anyhow, a story for another time. Yeah, I don't know. So I don't know much about Philip Guston, and I don't know why he painted those hooded figures. So I'm curious, although I doubt I doubt I'll, my thoughts will align with the kind of wholesale postponement of that exhibition. But I don't know what that was about. He didn't, at first glance, did not seem like a supporter of white supremacy.
The Klan?
Yeah, no, white supremacist movements. I'm sure that those were painted ironically, but also it seems like a question about involved in the discourse of painting in the 60s and 70s in New York that I'm just not privy to, really. I don't like how that gesture of painting the hooded figures would seem radical or political at the time. I'd love to know more.
Well, they were poo-pooed at the time because he had been such a successful abstract expressionist.
Uh-huh.
And his move to painting sort of cartoon Klansmen and Richard Nixon and stuff like that was viewed as gauche and dumb. Which is, you know, which treads on a kind of approach to these topics that I think you and I both have. But I would argue that, like, the Klansmen paintings are sort of, like, I think they're good. I think they're good paintings. And I think that, you know, they communicate sort of how stupid that mindset of intolerance, you know, it makes it goofy, as opposed to, you know, there was this Foucault quote where he's criticizing the movie Sallow by Pasolini.
Okay.
Where he's saying, which is itself an adaptation of 120 Days of Sodom by the Marquis de Sade, but it's set in sort of the decline of European fascism in the end of World War II.
Yeah.
And casting these sort of decadent fascists as like sort of ultimate perverts. And Foucault's argument is that, you know, fascists are actually sexually very boring. You know, like, to make them these exciting, dramatically perverse individuals is to cover up for the fact that they're just like pencil pushers, that like Jack Dorsey just wants to play ping pong. You know, like it's not like the idea that he's like entering a crypt and like doing sex rituals or something like that. He's not. He's just playing ping. He goes to Marfa and plays ping pong.
Yeah, you know, it perpetuates the myth that the people in power are protecting their own good lives or something, or is like some kind of special life,
and that their lives are and that their ideas, that the capacity that their capacity to sort of understand power as a scale, sort of exactly tracking with like the phenomenal ability to perform abuse. Is somehow like that their pleasure is different, I guess, or something like that. Like they're so different from us that like they are having like sex castle,
mm-hmm.
You know, whereas like normal guys like us just enjoy ping pong, you know?
Yeah.
But no, they all just enjoy ping pong. Like if it was, so Foucault's argument about Sallow is that if it was a true 120 days of, you know, if it was really what the fascists were doing at the end of the thing, they would be like gathering in a canteen and playing ping pong with each other or something, you know?
Right.
And then like punching out of the office and going home and eating dinner. And if they were to have sex, it would be boring missionary sex with their spouse, you know, cause they would not want to be seen to have, you know, the wrong kind of sex. Right. Cause they're mm-hmm. terrified of homosexuality, et cetera. So, you know, they lack all the capacity to be real perverts, is Foucault's argument, which is why they're fascists in the first place, sort of arguably. And this is a long way around to say that, like, I think those Gustin paintings kind of play a similar role to the critique Foucault's leveling. No, not that. To be fair, I actually also really did enjoy Sallow. I think it's a great movie. But
get that off your chest.
Yeah, I don't want to come across as the kind of guy who doesn't like Pasolini movies. I do, but I do think Foucault has a point about the politics of Sallow. You know, and I think and just as an aside, I think also Pasolini, who was murdered by the far right shortly afterwards, after making Sallow, had other priorities. You know, he wanted to make a movie that was obscene and that would annoy the Italian far right.
It worked,
and they killed him. So I think, you know, as a lasting analysis of fascism, I agree with Foucault, it's not correct. As a way to, like, piss off your local fascist, if you are Pier Paolo Pasolini, 100% successful. I also approve of people making stuff just to annoy someone else. I think that's a good reason to make an artwork. If you know it'll work, do it. You know what I mean? If the odds are high, like, and they will be, if they'll see it and be annoyed, that's great. If you're just going to shoot it out there and they will not be annoyed, it sucks, you know? So you, it's a fine line. It's a fine line to walk. But if you know that the Italian fascists will see you making your anti-Italian fascist movie, I say you should. But I think that Gustin's paintings are kind of like the critique Foucault's leveling, basically, that, like, you know, and that the bumbling Klansmen are this sort of diminution of sort of daily violence that's meted out throughout the entire sort of banal, sort of cartoony world, you know? And that also, I, so far as it goes, I think it's also an interesting approach versus like that extremely flawed Dana Schultz work, for example, that's like, oh, it's an abstract painting of Emmett Till, you know? Yeah. like that's not a good response.
It's about motherhood.
It's about motherhood. It's a terrible response to an awful subject, you know? Whereas, like, there's no specific incident being recalled by the, you know, it's like the pervasiveness of sort of the spy versus spy approach to
white nationalism,
political thinking, yeah, is like actually, you know, well dealt with in this case, because it's sort of just like addressing it as a topic, not addressing it as like an event per se. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And since it's a topic, it continues to actually work, you know. We still have, you know, like, we, he just did the thing. I saw one of the highlights of the debate was the Proud Boys being, you know, spoken to directly by the president.
Stand down and stand by.
Yeah.
Also, the president admitting that he cheats on his taxes, that was impressive.
I mean, who thought he did it? Oh my God! Of course he, like, I see.
But the way he did it was pretty
brilliant.
He's
got nothing to lose.
He said, "I just do what everyone does."
It's true.
Yeah, no, it is true. He's like, you know, I'm sure Biden has a fleet of accountants and lawyers making sure that he pays them minimum amount as well.
He's absolutely true. I mean, like, the things he did are on a much smaller scale, the things any freelancer does. You know, like, I make very little money at the end of the year, but, like, all those things, like, what can I write off?
Yeah.
I'm writing it all off. I'm writing off every single thing that I can make a claim that I can write off. I appear in my own work. I'm writing off my haircuts, you know? My haircuts do not cost the same amount as Donald Trump's haircuts, but also, like, my situation is much less complex than his hair-wise. Like, I think a lot of... he's getting a lot more done up there than...
Yeah, he's going to end up in Barbara Gladstone character territory if he doesn't watch out.
Yeah, totally.
But, you know, it's like... Was it Gladstone who had all the beauty tax stuff?
Oh, I forget. Well, she did go to jail.
Yeah, right. And it was for like, writing evasion. Off, like, you know, like, millions of dollars of, like, spa days or something.
Well, and then also not paying people.
Sure.
I don't think it was Barbara Gladstone, is it? Because Barbara Gladstone is still operating.
Yeah, no, it must have been one of the other big ones in New York. My mistake. Barbara's fine.
No, but who were we thinking? I know that the funny part is, when I worked for Michael Snow, he would talk about how he was always joking that, like, they were all just calling him all the time. He's just, like, fending off calls from, and he would name the gallerist who's now in jail, you know. He'd be like, oh, she's always going through my garbage, geez. As, like, a joke about how absolutely no one was calling him. but, yeah, as being a structural filmmaker, you know, it's a different world.
Yeah.
God, who was it? Anyway, but yeah, I don't know. I think it's, like, remarkably dumb that they canceled a Gustin retrospective, you know, because if anyone's, you know, like, and instead we get to listen to, like, what, like, three geriatric men, one guy from Fox News, the least progressive Democrat, and a reality television star talk about the race issue, you know, in quotes.
Yeah.
Like, that's more enlightening than, like, maybe the best paintings about racial strife by a white painter, you know? Like, it's, you know, or at least, like, the most complex take in that kind of painting. I don't know. I think the Gustin paintings are great. I think him and Leon Golub, like, you know, and I love Leon Golub as well, even though, like, you know, he's so much more based on showing the atrocity, I guess. But then, like, it's just more about cruelty in his case as well. Like, it's a topic, you know, it's not like, oh, you should care about specifically Angola or something. You know, this is how you should feel about Angola. It's like, human cruelty is really bad. People should not be this cruel. I'm Leon Golub. You know, I don't. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, I think the topics. I think people need to relax on top. Need to move into topics and move away from specific issues. That's what I mean. You know, you can talk about cruelty in a painting. I don't think you can talk about
Emmett Till.
I don't think you can specifically say anything unless you're like, "Wow, so bad, huh? Shouldn't have happened. What a shame." I sure wish those guys had not been so racist and done this bad thing to this person utterly undeserving of this cruelty. I think we all agree how to feel about something like that, we on the talking show. Certainly not, you know, in the scope of American politics. I'm sure some people, you know, just love that thing. But and they themselves are being spoken to directly by the president. So, yeah, I don't know. But
well, let our listeners be clear. As Steve launches this intense missive to all painters, that talking is a place where you can discuss politics and where politics should play out. So people you can take talking seriously, unlike our presidential candidates here in the United States.
Yeah, gosh, talking.
And I'd say so. Posting on social media is not talking. That I will take a firm stance on.
All right, so I think we should wrap it up soon. But what's your stance on dancing to music and pointing in space where text appears? Is that a kind of talking? Do you know what I'm talking about?
You're talking about Robert Ashley?
I was talking about TikTok videos, but I think the Venn diagram crosses over in exactly that place, so I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, well, as we've proven here on the talking show, I think it takes two to tango. Real talking, you're talking to someone and they can talk back, as often happens here on the talking show.
So phone lines are lighting up.
When you're just lobbing things onto social media platforms, and, you know, like tamping out the fiery comment session, that's not talking. Good morning,
well, folks,
Chinatown.
You heard it here first. Judge Dredd has passed his verdict. Good night.
I sentence you to the pit. Good night.